This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hey everyone, Gil Gross here. This is Tales from the Booth. Some of you may remember this format from last year. During Roland Garros, I am commentating 4 or 5 hours every morning because I have the early shift again on Tennis Channel Plus, which means for the first 4 or 5 hours of play every day, I'm only watching one court exclusively. And of course, I have to throw in the prep time and everything that goes with a week of commentary, which affects my coverage for the first 8 days of this slam. I have kind of created this format to basically be able to continue to come out with podcasts and shows while commentating. Now, last year, I did one of these every day, and it took a lot out of me. Too much out of me. I thought it was too taxing, too draining, and it probably took away from my ability to do both jobs at the highest level possible. So I'm going to be scaling back a little bit, taking some days off, and my goal is to do one of these every round, except for the fact that tomorrow I'm going to do a Nadal Zverev thing, and that's the only thing I think I'm going to talk about. And then the day after, I'm going to do a first round mailbag. So check the YouTube community tab because I'll have a post up very, very soon. Hopefully by the time this video comes up, I'll remember to put a post up so that people can comment on the mailbag, which I'll record after the first round is over. So I do a lot more spitballing in this format. It's less structured. I kind of go through many different topics in a little bit less detail. It was popular. It was well received. Today, I want to talk about some Sinner Alcaraz stuff, kind of a follow-up on their injuries. Alcaraz played today. Sinner is first up tomorrow against Christopher Eubanks. The two matches I called, I did Court 13 this morning, and I did Nicolas Moreno de Alboron versus Brandon Nakashima. And I mostly just want to talk about Nakashima because I think that In his quarter, which is the bottom quarter, Sinner's quarter, I did not put a dark horse. And he was one of the players that I thought about pulling the trigger on and didn't. And after watching that match, and yes, sometimes you can fall in love with players who you just are more focused on. But at this point, I would call him a dark horse. And I want to talk about why and decode his game a little bit because there's a lot of strange stuff going on. There is a great stat on the Roland Garros website that I want to talk about, and then I'm going to hit Murray versus Wawrinka. And then very quickly at the end, I want to talk about Terence Ottmann because he probably should have been DQ'd tonight. Tonight in Paris, but today where I'm at in California, where I'm, by the way, on air at 2 a.m. every morning, so sleep is a real challenge. And then also Nicolas Jarry. Nicolas Jarry lost to Corentin Moutet. It is the first player in the power rankings eliminated. He was number 10. So I want to cover that, although I was watching Murray Wawrinka, not that match. And the second screen was my New York Rangers hockey, who are in the Eastern Conference Finals. But I will talk about the result and just kind of my reaction to it. Starting with Alcaraz Sinner. So, first of all, I want to say that I love how many different opinions are out there right now about the men's singles draw for this French Open. folks have a lot of opinions and they're all over the map. And that is fun. That is good. I saw a graphic that basically showed the editorial staff of tennis.com, and it showed all of their picks. Didn't say who voted for who, but it said, here's the men's champion picks for the tennis.com experts, or, you know, just writers, right? So Alcaraz got 2 votes, Tsitsipas got 2 votes, Djokovic got a vote, Zverev got a vote, Rude got a vote, and Rublev got a vote. That was it. And I'm just looking at it and I went, oh my God, everybody got a vote except Sinner. Everybody got a vote except for Jannik Sinner. And it just got me thinking, because you guys also got to understand, like, I'm not always locked in on what other people are picking and everybody is saying. So that was one of the first things I saw. And I've also read the comments section, and I've seen a lot of opinions in the YouTube comments. And I'm thinking, like, is nobody with me on the Sinner thing? Am I all alone? Nobody's picking him. Nobody likes him right now. And I'm thinking, how unprecedented is this? A guy who has, he's barely lost in the last 7-8 months. Like, if you really look at it, he's barely lost since after the U.S. Open. He's lost once before a semifinal in a completed match. Since after the U.S. Open, that's happened once. I mean, crazy, crazy stuff. And, you know, he's lost a few matches here and there. But he won the last major. He leads the race by about 1,500 points. He has won 11 out of his last 13 matches against top 5 opponents, which is absurd. And he says the hip is no longer a concern. Now, I would push against that. You don't fully take him at his word. But you take all those things together, I think, how is someone who is first in the race, won the last major, has barely lost in the last 8 months, how is that player flying under the radar? Now, don't get me wrong. I think that there should be many, many different players getting picked at Roland Garros. It's not as if I'm up in arms and I think that everybody should think that Sinner's going to win. I just think that some people should be picking him. So I just found it strange when I saw that everybody got picked by the tennis.com experts except for Sinner. And I tweeted basically a version of what I just said, that I find it strange that somebody who's been so dominant for so long and won the last major is basically under the radar coming into Roland Garros. The discourse that followed is interesting. And that's really what I want to talk about. The discourse was interesting. It always is. After I kind of go out there, sometimes I make predictions. It's fascinating to see how people react and what people say. And it gives me a chance to develop my thoughts a whole lot more. So the first thing, what should I start with? Should I start with the injuries? No. Let me start with the clay thing. Because the most popular reply was, well, it's clay, right? Like, the reason why you shouldn't believe in Sinner is because this is clay. And that's why. And there were a plethora of different angles that I saw. I saw some people say Sinner is flat out bad on clay, or he has been bad on clay. I saw people say that, you know, Sinner is unproven on clay, which is a lot, you know, there's a lot of truth to that. He is unproven. He hasn't accomplished much. So I actually, first of all, for anybody theorizing that that's the reason why people are hesitant to pick him, I agree with that. I do think that's the reason. Because Sinner hasn't accomplished much on clay. And I know that. And I do not care. And it's something that I haven't fully developed my thoughts on this in a little while. I watch the tennis. And I try to be forward thinking based on what I'm seeing on the tennis court, not beholden to results that I can look up on Wikipedia or Tennis Abstract. because if you go on Wikipedia and Tennis Abstract and you see, well, Sinner lost early at Roland Garros last year. Sinner has won a few big titles on hard court, and he hasn't won a big title on clay. His win percentage is a few points lower on clay than it is on hard court. So you can look at that and you can be like, well, I'm not good on clay. I'd much rather be a little bit forward thinking here. Consider me a strong skeptic that clay in the long run of Jannik Sinner's career is going to be a surface that yields significantly inferior results. If there are slight differences, like if he's a hair worse on clay, maybe, you know, maybe I could see that. I'm not convinced that that will be the case, but I'm not going to argue against that. But to think that there's going to be any substantial drop-off on clay for Sinner, that idea makes no sense to me based on how he plays tennis. Sorry. And how do you explain the results? Because results also matter. Well, I think there are a couple things. First of all, Jannik Sinner, the last time he played a clay court season, and every time he's played a full clay court season in his career since he didn't get to do it this year, has not been an elite player. So, of course, his results do not reflect that of an elite player on clay, because he wasn't elite on hard court either. He wasn't. He had no big titles on hard court either last time he played a clay court season healthy, right? So he has steeply improved since the clay court season last year. Steeply, in a variety of areas, in a way that's been astonishing to watch. And he didn't get to really show his mettle this clay court season, I don't think. He didn't get to show those improvements on a new surface. We know what happened. He was up big in a semifinal in Monte Carlo. A bad call went against him, and Tsitsipas came roaring back and beat him at his best tournament. You know, Stefanos Tsitsipas' best tournament, where he beat loads of other good players, and Sinner was coming off of a extremely taxing March. So that's the picture in Monte Carlo. And then in Madrid, he wins a bunch of match. He wins a few matches and then withdraws because of the hip. And I'm going to talk about the hip. Don't worry. So that was clay court season this year. But the results are misleading. And the tennis, he's got everything I look for on clay. He's got physicality. He's got consistency. And he's got weight of shot. And those are the three pillars of all of the great clay court players that I've seen in the modern era. It's no longer about grinding, and it's no longer about defense. It's guys who play, who are extremely physical, who play high margin aggression with consistency and a high level of weight of shot. And this is a guy who has shown incredible displays of fitness in the last 6 months. And when he was a young player, that wasn't the case. But you have to adapt your brain. He's a different guy now. Unless the hip affects the fitness, which it may. He's got an extremely whippy, heavy forehand that responds really well to extra time, responds very well to high contact points, and there is nobody in the last, you know, this year, I'll say, like since the Australian Open forward, there's nobody who's played more sound, high percentage tennis, making the right decisions all the time and making sure to be consistent and not make a lot of errors. And I mean, to me, that is a clay court player. And I don't know what people are looking for when they say that his game is not suited for clay, other than maybe a little bit of craftsmanship in the sense of, you know, sharp angles and drop shots. Like a little bit of that court craft that can come in handy if you don't have the power to hit through the clay, which I would argue Sinner does in spades, so it doesn't matter all that much. The style of tennis that he's been playing has been perfect for any surface, including clay. And it's also a product of the era of tennis that we're in, okay? Because think about it, like the last three, and I know it's it's been Nadal and Djokovic, and they're special. I get that. But the last three Australian Open champions have won Roland Garros. This is the era we're in. It ain't that different, depending on the style of tennis you play, depending on how well-rounded you are. If you have certain quirks in your game, if you have certain strengths and weaknesses that are very harsh and well-defined, then surface ends up mattering a whole lot more to you. Sinner, Djokovic, Nadal, they're just good at basically everything. Surface ends up not mattering that much. I also think, first of all, the thought that he, well, let me put it this way. I think the Altmaier loss last year kind of traumatized people. I really do. There was one reply that said, I got to find it here. There was one reply from some rando, but I'm happy that the rando put this reply because it made me look up this statistic. The guy said, or woman said, it's clay. He loses to the most random players on clay. So I went, okay, well, I know that's not true, but let's look up some stats. So Sinner has won 18 of his last 19 matches against players outside the top 50 on clay. And that one loss was Altmaier. All right, but let's even hold him to a higher standard. Let's see how he's done against players outside the top 20. Sinner has won 27 of his last 29 matches against players outside the top 20. That's an even far more impressive stat than the whole top 50 thing. 27 out of his last 29. One of those two losses, the one that wasn't Altmaier, was to Francisco Cerúndolo, who I think everybody agrees is easily a top 20 player on clay when he's at his best. That Altmaier loss was a huge outlier, and I think it was jarring, and it stood out to people so much that maybe it's hard to really see that. So I just think sometimes you got to be forward thinking about it. Yeah, Alcaraz hasn't accomplished that much on clay. I know that, and I do not care. And by the way, people are saying the same thing. This kind of reminds me a little bit of early 2022 when I was pumping up Alcaraz, and people were saying, what has he proven to you to act like he's so good? Because I was saying he's generational, he's completely special, he is totally different than any prospect we've seen in the last 20 years. And everyone was like, well, he has no slams, so what the hell are you talking about? And it's like, sometimes you have to watch the tennis and be forward-thinking based on what you see. And that's, to me, Sinner in the last 8 months. Now, the injury thing. So clay was the one reply. I just wanted to cover that. But then there's also the hip part, and some people were upset at the last bullet point of my tweet because I said that Sinner says his hip is fine. And they're saying, if you believe that Sinner says his hip is fine, then what about Alcaraz? Why are you worried about Alcaraz's injury but not Sinner's injury? And this is always going to get a little bit sticky, and I feel uncomfortable about it myself. Am I being a hypocrite about the injuries? No. I'm not being a hypocrite about the injuries. They're different. Now, to some extent, this stuff is unknowable. And it could be that Sinner suffers with the as a result of the physical issue, and then Alcaraz ends up being fine. There are scenarios in which that is the case. And if somebody picks Alcaraz to win the Roland Garros title, I don't blame them at all. I don't think that's a bad pick at all. But it's not my pick because the injury does concern me. And there are reasons that I have to be more concerned about Carlitos compared to Yannick. And I was watching T2 today. I heard Andrea Petkovic say something that made me feel so much better about myself. Because I was questioning myself a little bit. Am I crazy? Does this theory that I have about movement injuries versus arm injuries, does it have merit? Is it true? Andrea Petkovic, unfortunately, and she'd be the first to say this, has injured every part of her body. She knows something about this. And here's what she said. She said, quote, any injury in the hitting arm feels different because it can affect you long after you're seemingly healthy. Just in your head, you're afraid of hitting the ball at full power for a long time, which is the worst thing that can happen to a tennis player. Yeah. That's exactly, and maybe I didn't communicate it that well, that's exactly what I'm so terrified with Alcaraz. The fact that, and I did say in the preview, the arm injuries to me are way worse than the movement injuries, as long as the movement injuries aren't super severe. And then of course they're really bad if you need hip resurfacing, or if you're Zverev and you completely tore up your entire ankle, right? Unless it's at that level, the movement injuries aren't as concerning to me as the arm injuries. And that is why, because I think it's such a mental thing. And by the way, Alcaraz has backed this up. So it's not as if Sinner said that the hip is no longer a concern. Alcaraz hasn't spoke that optimistically. He said that the arm feels good, but he also says that he's still afraid to hit 100%. And most people who watched the JJ Wolf match today, in which Sinner wiped the floor with the American, I was unable to watch because I was commentating, but most people say that it did look like Alcaraz was still holding back, and that Wolf didn't play a high enough level to really be a good measuring stick for Alcaraz. So Alcaraz has reinforced my thoughts. Petkovic has reinforced my thoughts. And by the way, one thing that I didn't mention, the timeline for Carlos has been considerably longer. That's an injury that started in Monte Carlo. There was a false comeback, which you always hate, the dreaded false comeback. And it went all the way up until Rome. Had to pull out of Rome, started hitting probably second week of Rome. Sinner's was not in the equation until midway through Madrid, and then he missed one tournament. So Alcaraz has been affected by this injury for the span of more than a month. Sinner has been affected by his injury for 2 weeks. So, it's this big internet thing to try to find hypocrisy and double standards and inconsistencies. And it's the worst internet thing, because half the time it's people who are looking at two scenarios that are different and wanting it to be treated exactly the same when they're not the same. You have different circumstances with different injuries. So that is my response to the discourse. Again, I hope that this came off in a way that was informative and entertaining and not like useless. I'm randomly, for no reason, defending myself against, anonymous internet people. But I thought the idea that, well, it's Clay and the injury thing, I thought those were things that I haven't really covered, and that it would be good for me to kind of tell you where I'm at with those things. And then, of course, the hesitancy is like, Sinner might lose. And it's not as if, again, it's a prediction, so it's not as if I'm saying that I'm right or I'm more right than anybody else, but my main point here is like, there aren't a lot of good reasons to ignore Sinner as a contender, and I'm pretty staunch when I say that in terms of everything all added up together. I just don't think there's any good enough reason to ignore Sinner as a contender, and that's why when I saw the tennis.com thing where Alcaraz, Tsitsipas, Djokovic, Zverev, Ruud, and Rublev all get votes, Sinner doesn't, I raised my eyebrow. That's all.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, so let me talk about everything else. Is going to be quicker. Brandon Nakashima, he beats Nicolas Moreno de Albarán in a match that he completely dominated, but he won in four sets because Moreno de Albarán won in a tiebreak set where it was one of those where he lost more total points but was able to hold tight games and force the tiebreak and then eke out the tiebreak. So I think Nakashima is back. He really just kind of went downhill last year after what was a very good season in 2022, where he kind of broke out. He won the Next Gen Finals. He beat Jiří Lehečka twice. He beat Matteo Arnaldi. He beat Jack Draper. He swept through those Next Gen Finals. He won San Diego, the 250, after the U.S. Open that year. And he was consistent at the majors that year. Since then, he hadn't won a single match at a slam. He snapped a 5-match losing streak against Moreno de Albarán by winning this first-round match at RG. But I mentioned the consistent clay court season that he's had. In all six events he's played, he's won two matches and then lost the third, now has a 13-6 record across all levels, including ATP tournament qualifying on the clay. And I've had my doubts about Nakashima as a clay court player just because I've never really trusted his forehand, and he doesn't defend all that well. But the forehand is coming off a lot better. In general, he's been a difficult player for me to understand because statistically, he is a serve bot. It's true. You look at his hold percentages, and you'll find that they're around 87%. You look at his break percentages, you'll find that they're between like 13 and 16%. There are six players on the ATP Tour who hold serve at a rate above 87%. Sinner, Hurkacz, Zverev, Djokovic, Fritz. And Nakashima, in his tour-level matches this year, is at 86.9%. He is just a tenth away from that 87 mark. So he holds, baby, but he does not break. Only two players are lower than 14%, which is Alexander Vukic and Chris Eubanks. Those are the only two players who are lower than 14%. And Nakashima, last 52 weeks, just a hair over 14%. But he doesn't seem like a serve bot when you watch him play. He's not that tall. He doesn't serve 135 or anything like that. He's not hyper-offensive. So you watch it and you're like, what the heck is going on? Why can't he break serve? Why can't anybody break him? It doesn't make any sense. And I'm trying to crack that code. And just watching carefully this match, here's what I came up with. His spot serving is insanely good. That's kind of what I got. And that's the only explanation for the serve dominance, despite the fact that the speed is nothing crazy. He is so precise. He is just picking corner after corner after corner. It is kind of Federer-like, the way he's serving just with crazy precision out of a platform stance with a very, very fluid right arm that just kind of flows beautifully through the motion. And I think that's why he's dominating on his serve. Did not get broken. This is a clay court match against a guy in Nicolas Moreno de Alboran who is not incredible, certainly, but he is, I would say, someone over the course of four sets, he is a return-centric, clay-centric player. He did not touch Nakashima's serve. He saw two break points and couldn't convert. Nakashima was so dominant on his serve, especially the first delivery. I just think he's hitting spots, and I think that's the big reason. Why can't he break serve? I think that comes down a lot to the movement. The more I watch Nakashima, the more I see someone who is very average athletically. He just doesn't move all that well. And I think when you push him into the corners and you make him play defense, the speed around the court is what is lacking. The other explanation is his forehand return, which is why I think the clay might actually end up being right now his best surface, which I wouldn't have thought. But the returning was the best I've ever seen from Nakashima in terms of his ability to drive his forehand return deep in the court, which I think he struggled to do. I've seen in the past that he's blocked, has been willing to block his forehand return. Then I've seen him just really struggle on his forehand return. And I do think that as a young player, guys who weren't scouting him very hard were serving way too often to his backhand. And then when Nakashima rose in 2022 and became more of a household name and got inside the top 50, that's when I think players started to say, okay, we actually have to serve his forehand, and I'm aware of this, and his results started to dip. So maybe the extra time on his forehand return is going to make him more legit as a clay guy right now, or is going to make him tougher to beat on the clay. He plays Hubert Hurkacz in the next round, and Hurkacz went five sets, which is never a surprise because that's kind of what Hurkacz tends to do early in majors. He gets into these really close matches. He's unable to separate himself against lower-ranked competition. I had some hope that maybe that would change because he really hasn't lost a lot of matches in upset fashion this year. But no, it was five sets against the Japanese qualifier who I tried to go to the results page and it didn't come up, and I do not memorize the name here. And I don't have time to edit these shows, so it's just going to be freewheeling. Mochizuki. So that's a five-setter, and the thing is with Hurkacz's style and with Nakashima's style, that match is going to come down to like 4 points. I'm sorry, it just is. They're going to play tie breaks. You know, Hurkacz and Nakashima, they both hold at 87%, so do the math. So that's how it's going to be, and therefore you're going to have a really high level of variance, so you better believe Hurkacz next round, upset alert, and Brandon Nakashima in that Yannick Sinner quarter where I did not pick a dark horse, I am going to amend that and say he is my dark horse because he has provided consistent results throughout this clay court season. The forehand is coming off really well, and he certainly has enough confidence at this point. He's proven in the past that he can be a dangerous player. That's Nakashima. Murray Wawrinka, I thought I would have a lot more to say about it. First of all, I enjoyed seeing them share the court together. However, they really did show their age because they came out with a lot of intensity and they played a lot of good points for the first hour and a half or so. And then come the hour 45 mark, both of them slowed down significantly. And they just looked like different players after an hour 45. Both of them, on both sides of the net, they were 20% slower. You know, Murray was probably 30% slower, and Stan was probably 20% slower in the third set. So that was like a wake-up call. It's like, yeah, this is where we're at with these guys. I was most impressed with Stan's variety, actually. That was the one thing that I didn't expect that I thought made a pretty major difference in the match. He was the one who came out serving volleying from time to time. he was the one coming forward off of his plus one. I saw, you know, Murray got hot on the drop shot, and a lot of them were winners. But there were some clutch plays when Wawrinka was able to get to the drop shot where he executed good redrops. He executed good shoveled, angled passing shots off the drop shot. I saw some short slicing, some that led to errors, especially when Murray's legs got tired, some that led to passing shots when Murray was kind of forced in against his own will. He took some floating returns out of the air with some great drive volleys off the forehand side. So I'm seeing Stan do all these different things, and I was watching and I'm like, isn't Murray supposed to be the more crafty of the two? Isn't Andy supposed to have the creative mind and all these different ideas? It looked like Stan was the one with ideas on the court and not so much Murray, which was really interesting to see. And then, you know, I thought the steak and potatoes of Stan's game was also pretty good. When I've been watching him recently, it's kind of come down to his positioning. And when he's in good position and he's moving well and his feet are in the right spot, he still strikes the ball extraordinarily well. I just think that part of it, getting in the right position, has been really inconsistent. And there have been, like, not only does he not defend nearly as well as he used to, that's a given. Everybody knows that. I also think, though, that sometimes there's been the more subtle footwork things that have made him more inconsistent and have made it so that there are kind of patches of unforced errors. But he really stayed away from that in this match, I should say. Murray has probably undergone the most jarring racket change that we've seen. I don't know when I've seen somebody change a racket that has been as weird to see as Murray playing with the Yonex E-Zone. Like, that head frame, it's so ingrained in what Andy Murray looks like. And when you think about it, maybe Novak a little bit less, but to see Nadal without, and Nadal probably is the strongest association with the racket. When you think of Nadal without the yellow Babolat arrow drive, or Federer without the Wilson frame, and again, Djokovic without the head, although Djokovic was Wilson early. It's rare you see a change for a player of that stature at this point in the career, and it's just weird to look at. What's the effect? I mean, I thought there was a lot of juice on the first serve until his legs got tired. His ground stroke speeds, particularly in the second set, were definitely higher, but he still doesn't hit as heavy as Stan. Stan, who uses a much thinner beam, like visually there's a huge difference between that E-Zone 100 that Murray is using and Wawrinka's racket, which is painted like a Percept, which is Yonex's control line, but I believe it's an old V-Core. I think it's an old V-Core Pro, because I'm assuming Stan didn't actually change the racket, but maybe he did. In fact, I recall maybe seeing something on Tennis Nerd that he did change recently, so maybe. But the point is, you can see, like, Stan's frame is half the size as Murray's frame, which is going to kind of equate to the level of power. Stan still hits a bigger ball. I feel like for Murray to reach back for the speeds, he has to flatten out his shots, and he does lose the consistency when he tries to play power tennis. He does not maintain the consistency. The misses seem to be a little bit more drastic than I'm used to for Murray. Now, on the flip side, on the good side, there is no sacrifice on feel because the drop shot was Andy's best shot in the second set. One example, though, by the way, like on the consistency front for Murray, the forehand at 5-4-30 all in the second set, Andy can't miss. He just can't miss that ball. And sometimes it's as simple as you're going to have one chance here and you have to take it. And that was it, because it was a love 30 opening for Murray, and Wawrinka played a lot of really good points in the next several points, over the course of the next several points. But in that 30-all point, Murray got a look, and he had a forehand to attack, and he put it in the net. And it would have given him break point to try to get back into the second set and stay in the match. Turns out Murray's legs might have been going, and maybe that contributed to the miss. Because, again, Third set, Andy just completely ran out of gas. But it's so clear that Wawrinka was not only more crafty, but it's so easy for him to generate easy offense from the back of the court with the way he moves his backhand around, with the weight of shot and the extra RPMs that he gets and the muscle on his forehand. And look, I mean, they don't defend well anymore. Neither of them do. So it's kind of about who is going to attack more effectively and be the bully out there, be the hammer, not the nail. And Wawrinka's just better at that on a clay court than Murray is. I think that's what it came down to, and that's all I have to say. Last two things. Terrence Ottman. I recently saw a video on Twitter. I originally saw a tweet from Jose Morgado that he hit a ball in frustration and it hit someone in the stands and that he was not DQ'd. Now, because I have not seen any decent angle on what actually specifically happened, I am not going to take a stance on something that I did not fully see. Because you see him hit the ball and then you don't see what happens after the ball leaves the purview of the camera angle. So I'm not going to take a stand on he should have been DQ'd, he shouldn't have been DQ'd, but it certainly looked like he should have been DQ'd. The thing is, I'm very curious about Terrence Ottman, and he first got on my radar in Phoenix, and some of you may remember that I talked about him. He is very talented. He is a terrific personality. He is going to be a tour-level player, but I gotta say, I'm fascinated to see what happens when people actually learn about him and start watching him play and he starts to be thrusted into the spotlight that comes with being a tour level player, because I have never seen a more emotionally volatile player. He has zero control over himself. He is an absolute loose fuse. So it came as no surprise to me that he did something like this. Even Blair Henley tweeted that it came as, and she is very tuned in to what players are like personality-wise, emotionally. Like, she's on that stuff. And she tweeted that she wasn't surprised. Now, when I tweeted it that he's the most emotionally volatile player, I just thought, he just lost a five-setter. Everyone's going to figure it out eventually. It's not that insightful a tweet. It's kind of useless. It's kind of kicking someone when they're down. Not to say that Blair should take it down or anything, but I decided to delete it. I decided to delete that tweet, but I just wanted to mention it because I gotta say, Ottman is gonna be a lightning rod, and I want to get ahead of it. I want to say it right now, because this guy has the worst temper I've ever seen, and pretty soon everybody's gonna learn his name. And by the way, it affects his ability to win tennis matches way more than an Andre Rublev, by the way, because Rublev tries his ass off every point. Ottman gets upset and starts tanking. And that's a big difference between the two. Let's end on Nicolas Jarry, who loses to Corentin Moutet. This should not be shocking. I felt that he certainly earned the number 10 spot in the power rankings. Certainly earned that with what he has accomplished over the course of the last two clay court seasons. But Jarry losing the first round here, I'm sorry to say, it's just a continuation of the norm. It is right on par with what is to be expected for Nicolas Jarry based on what we've seen. He is right now a high ceiling, low floor player, and we've seen it all year long. He is 3-2 against top 10 players. He is 8-9 against opponents outside the top 50. He has played 11 events this year. 11 events. Hear me out. Four times he's been quarterfinal or better. Twice he's been to the final. So that's a pretty good hit rate. Four times going deep in 11 events. Six times he's lost in the first round, which leaves room for just one tournament where you look at him and it's kind of in the middle. You go, yeah, he was all right. He won one match. He won two matches. No, it's either he's making a run or he's losing in the first round. But six first round losses in 11 events played. That is half his tournaments. So it should come as no shock, especially when you consider the fact that Corentin Moutet has played really well at Roland Garros over the years. He is extremely crafty, tons of variety, So if you're someone who's going to try to be really aggressive and try to hit the ball really big, he is going to constantly mess with your rhythm and your contact points. He's going to throw the ball high in the air. He's going to slice his backhand. He is going to defend really, really hard and make you play extra balls on top of all that. Plus, there is nobody in the world who is going to use a crowd quite as much as Corentin Moutet and egg on a Roland Garros crowd as much as Moutet. So this was a home game for him. It was a hostile environment for Jarry. And I believe the same thing happened in Chile, only the... Oops. I just spilled my drink. Only in the reverse. And Moutet wins this one again over Jarry. So I'm not that surprised that Nicolas Jarry is the first one out of the power rankings. That'll do it. I'll be back tomorrow for analysis on Nadal Zverev. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.